It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about gangster culture and the world of gangsters in the 1920s and 1930s. Coming up later in the hour, I'll talk with Jonathan Eich. He's author of Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captured America's Most Wanted Gangster, and he'll be visiting Iowa in the very near future. But right now, I am at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum in West Branch, Iowa, touring the exhibit Ain't Misbehavin', The World of the Gangsters. It's on display through October 23rd, and I'm here with Marcus Eckhart. He's curator of the exhibit.
I'm glad to be here. Yeah.
Now, this is kind of an unusual exhibit for the Hoover Museum in some ways, but what inspired you to explore the world of Prohibition and the speakeasies and the gangster culture at the Hoover Museum?
Well, part of our mission is to explore the life and times of Herbert Hoover, and he was very prominent in the 1920s as Secretary of Commerce. But also, I mean, this is what was going on in his life and also when he was president. So Prohibition ends within 6 months of FDR being elected. So that was a campaign issue as well.
All right. So this is something that Herbert Hoover as president had to deal with?
Yes.
Yeah. Although it had been in place for quite some time when he went into office.
Yeah, I don't know that he was a supporter of Prohibition, but, I mean, he wasn't pro-Prohibition, but he was a supporter of the laws that were in existence at the time.
All right, so the law went into effect in 1920, and the changes took place all over the United States. What were some of the first things that started to happen culturally when manufacture and sale of alcohol was shut down?
People still wanted to drink, and I think people started making their own alcohol. People were figuring out ways to get it. A speakeasy, which is what we think of as the classic place of where people would drink, could be as small as one room with two tables, or one table and somebody having a bottle of something that they didn't get rid of. Now, when Prohibition becomes a law of the land, what you have is not illegal to have. It's not illegal to be in possession of alcohol. It's illegal to transport it. It's illegal to manufacture it or to sell it. So there were various ways that people tried to do different things. So I think that's what you see. So, again, the romantic side of Prohibition is the speakeasy.
And we are standing in a speakeasy right now. We entered through a very innocent-looking hat shop, and now we're in a full-blown speakeasy. And this is kind of what we think about as the stereotypical speakeasy or the stereotypical scene of the jazz age in the 1920s.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, there's these large clubs that were, we think, in the larger cities. The Cotton Club in New York City, for example, is one. I mean, there's whole movies made about these places and all the events and all the famous people that went through there. Very famous musicians, played in these things. Obviously, Louis Armstrong, Vic Spiderbeck played. This is where that music was able to be free and be unleashed, if you will.
And we in the speakeasy, we have a little display on Vic Spiderbeck, who, of course, is our main contribution in Iowa to the jazz age, but also a little bit about Louis Armstrong, including one of his trumpets, that's so cool.
Yeah, the trumpet is from on loan to us from the Louis Armstrong Museum in New York City. It is not one that he played at this time, this era. At the beginning of the 1920s, he was actually, along with Vic Spiderbeck, we were both playing trumpet, or cornet, excuse me. Cornet was the instrument of that time, but Louis Armstrong transitioned to the trumpet in the late 20s. That trumpet is one that he played. The mouthpiece, if you look at the mouthpiece, it actually has his name on it as well. So it's pretty neat to have that stuff.
So this is, like I said, this is the stereotype. This is the kind of thing that makes people think, oh, the 20s were so cool. But yeah. let's move a little further into the exhibit, because you go beyond the stereotype, beyond the glamour, to show us what's really going on.
Right, yeah, well, the exhibit being the world of the gangster, we talk about the essentially the four ways that gangsters are making money. So there is obviously dealing with alcohol. So you have
and
people who are.
Maybe we should start there, because there's this lovely little bakery over here. And if we go through the door of the bakery, we find that there's a lot more going on, or the Busy Bee Cafe, I guess it is.
Right. Yeah. So. As you come into the exhibit, you see you go out the back door of the speakeasy, essentially through an alley, out onto another side street, which has got some different storefronts. One of the storefronts, behind one of the storefronts, you know, because these things were not out in the open. Alcohol was not.
It was illegal.
It was illegal, right. So how did, you know, again, the gangsters were doing illegal things. This is how they got their money. So what we have here is one of the original Templeton Rye stills, borrowed from Templeton and the family there. And the family, they were the kingpin at the time, invested his money wisely, I would say, from the gains which he got, and they're pretty successful farmers as a result of that, I would say. Land was cheap in the 20s, and they bought well.
And so this is one of the actual stills that was used to make Templeton Rye?
Yes. Yeah, that is the actual still there. So that's the tank where they had put the mash inside of there. The coil well, not attached now. The family actually displays this in their living room. So it's been cleaned up, so it's not as dirty looking as it might have been. So it's a little bit shinier copper than you'd expect. But that's the coil there. The tank that the coil would have run through rusted out, so that doesn't exist anymore.
Well, and of course, we think about gangster culture as something that really was focused in the big cities, especially Chicago, but all the big cities. But, I mean, Templeton Rye was something being done in Iowa, and were there a lot of people making alcohol in Iowa?
I think there are a lot of people making alcohol, yes, in Iowa and everywhere. I mean, it's so prevalent, it's almost comical. There's talks of people actually using aircraft flying over cornfields in Iowa to find where the hidden barrels are in fields, because we all know how tall corn can be in Iowa. You can hide a lot of stuff out in a cornfield if you can't see it. So they're using, you know, aircraft in the 30s or early. The 20s and early 30s to look around and find stuff. I think that's amazing to me.
Yeah. Well, and of course, alcohol had to be transported once it was made. Was there a big transport business in Iowa? A lot of bootleggers smuggling alcohol into the big cities.
Yes. And it went either by truck or actually by rail. Out of Templeton, there would be trucks that would go in, and they would load up a truck. And a story that I had heard was that they would actually, because they were afraid of the policemen showing up or some sort of a raid happening while they're loading up the truck, every barrel that would be put onto the truck, they would hand the guy, you know, $30. I would not be surprised if rail cars of stuff left Templeton. Templeton, I think, as the size of the community, people knew what was happening. So it would surprise me. Well, I don't know what's happening, but I think stuff is happening.
Well, all right. So this is probably part of gangster culture that we hear the most about. Or, again, you know, this is kind of the glamorous side, the smuggling, the Templeton Rye, and, you know, so these are things people tell stories about. Let's move next door to maybe one of the ways that gangsters were making money and using money that was not quite as glamorous.
Yeah, we talk about graft. So graft is the idea of paying off police officers or political, you know, politicians to look the other way so that you can do what you want to do, which may have been happening in Templeton, for example. Definitely happened in Chicago and New York City, all over the country. There's, you know, thoughts that maybe 50% of police officers at one time were taking money on the side. And it was ways that people did things. I think it's, you know, you see, you know, if you look around, there's a political cartoon on the wall that's got a number of people with their hands out behind their back, you know.
Right, a prohibition agent, a police officer, a politician, a magistrate.
Yeah, city hall, so judges. Right. So I think at one point early in Al Capone's career, he was arrested. And he said, I'll be out of jail in a day, in less than a day. I won't spend, you know, that much time. And so, yeah, he got out and no charges were pressed. You know, murders are happening and, you know, people are being paid off. You know, juries are paid off. I guess the term was Chicago amnesia, where you'd pay somebody off. I don't know. I didn't see anything. So they could move on from that. You look into the 20s in the Chicago area and, you know, the gangsters wanted their guy to be elected, so there are, you know, shootouts in the streets over around elections and campaigns and things. So it's really, you know, very dirty times, if you will. And I think in some ways, also as a result of prohibition and the police officers and the graft and the corruption that you see as a part of that, we have lost, there was a loss of respect for police officers at that time. And I think we're still recovering from that. I mean, if you think about it, I think before that people were in the United States were pretty law enforcement, law-abiding citizens. And I think that's changed. That changed at that time because, oh, everybody else is getting a drink, so why can't I go get a drink? You know, I'm not doing anything wrong. And I think that's a continuation of that lack, that respect that was lost at that time as a result of that.
So because people felt that the law was unfair with prohibition, they lost respect for the law.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, an interesting thing about that is that it was easier to get a drink during prohibition than it was before prohibition. So that's a surprise because it's everywhere and all of this revenue is lost to the government, so they're unable to enforce as much. They you know, the taxes that come from making alcohol, which is one of the ways that prohibition ended, was FDR saying we need the money. We lost, you know, 30, I don't know the exact number, but, you know, 30% of the federal budget was lost because of you know, alcohol related revenues are gone. And of course, without government controls on the alcohol, you get some pretty horrible stuff. And there's some ideas that different types of drinks become, the mixed drink becomes, you know, the sidecar, the gimlet. These types of drinks that are more fruity flavored are done on purpose that way because the alcohol was so horrible. You got to cover up that flavor with something that people would want to drink. Right. And possibly to, you know, in case there was a raid in that place, they can chug and go. So they can, you know, slam a drink and get out of there as fast as they can without leaving it on the table.
I'm at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum in West Branch, Iowa today, touring the exhibit Ain't Misbehavin', The World of the Gangsters. It's on display through October 23rd, and I'm here today with Marcus Eckhart. He's curator of the exhibit. We will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. When prohibition became the law in 1920, the nation's thirst for alcohol gave rise to a new criminal culture. It made way for the gangster. This hour, the gangsters of the 1920s and 30s. And later in the hour, I'll talk with Jonathan Eig. He's author of Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captured America's Most Wanted Gangster. But right now, I am at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum in West Branch, Iowa, with Marcus Eckhart. He is curator of the exhibit Ain't Misbehavin', The World of the Gangsters. It's on display through October 23rd. And we're exiting a flower shop where a policeman was receiving a bribe.
A hefty bribe.
Right. Yeah. And now here's a drugstore, just a simple pharmacy.
Right, yeah. Well, pharmacies are actually very interesting at this time period because you could get a prescription from your doctor if you needed to get alcohol. So you could get alcohol at your pharmacist because, you know, for unsteady nerves or something, you could go and actually have prescriptions, you know. And pharmacies did wonderful. The Walgreens, as a matter of fact, blossomed in the 1920s as a seller of alcohol from prescriptions. So you get this industry, which is obviously still around today. It's on their website. But I had no idea that this was something that was a big part of that. So, yeah, so the drugstore was specifically chosen as one of our storefronts because of that reason. Inside the drugstore here, in the back room, there's actually the term vice, which I didn't understand quite what it meant at the time. In the 20s, it actually is talking about prostitution, which is another way which gangsters were making money.
So let's raise the curtain here. Maybe I should knock, but right. You know, we have a silhouette of a woman, an alluring woman smoking a cigarette back here, telling us a little bit of what's going on in the back room.
Right, there was in the Quad Cities, a woman named Helen Van Dale, who was the queen of the brothels, worked with John Looney. John Looney was gangster in the Quad Cities. He actually was a gangster before Prohibition, I would say. So he's a nasty man. He's I mean, we think of, again, this is part of the side of Prohibition, that we think of, oh, these gangsters, oh, they weren't that bad. Oh, gosh, they were horrible, gruesome, bloody.
Well, and I mean, prostitution obviously so often involves sex trafficking and actual slavery.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, so this is out of the, I mean, this is another surprise to me, was out of the Quad Cities, they're providing women for Capone. And for Johnny Torrio, who are the, you know, who are, you know, the Chicago outfit. Those, they're providing that for them. You find out that, you know, these, you know, they often, women started in that business and they, mm-hmm. you know, progress on, I think, depending on how ruthless they are.
Preying on young women who may be going to the city looking for work.
Right.
Unattached.
Right. Yeah. Or getting sucked into it somehow, and that's so. Yeah. Again, more of the horrors of the gangster era.
And then we're in a gambling den. What's the? Oh, it's a butcher shop. gambling den, butcher shop.
Well, it's where the bookie lived. Again, gangsters made money through bookies and through illegal gambling. There were specific cities around the country which were known for gambling. Cicero in Chicago, outside of Chicago, was Hot Springs, Arkansas, Galveston, Texas, and Miami, Florida. Those were, you know, big ways that gangsters had money, and you know, they're illegally, you know, rigging the games, as you will.
I saw some dice in your alleyway there. Are those weighted dice, or can I play a genuine game of craps with you?
You can play craps. Yeah. I won't
You're
tell
not
you.
Cheating.
Depends how much money we're putting on which dice I'll get out. But there were cruise ships that were actually on the coast that you would go outside the limit and you could drink on the cruise ships and gamble. So there were different ways that people dealt with that as well. Again, gambling is also trying to be enforced by people, but there were these cities that it was just people just looked the other way.
With gambling, I see a sign on the wall here that tells us that there were states that legalized gambling on horse races to try to replace some of the taxes lost on alcohol sales. So that just fed the rise of gambling in the United States.
Right. Yeah. Al Capone did not like to lose horse races, so he would pay off whoever and there's. There's lots of stories at this time, and one of the interesting things about researching this was talking to people. I couldn't get places or names of, you know, people still don't want to talk about what their family was, their involvement in it.
Well, of course, along with the rise of all this criminal activity, and in spite of the fact that many law enforcement officers were being bribed and paid off, there were also law enforcement officers who were trying to do their jobs and keep people safe.
Right.
So that's where we go next.
Yeah, law enforcement is really starting at this time to try to catch criminals and to, I mean, part of it is, you know, there's Get Capone, the book that you're going to be talking about later on, is how do you get Capone? How do you catch him? He's not keeping much of a paper trail. The paper trail is coded. How do you get these guys when, you know, nothing is owned by Capone. His house is owned by his wife. He doesn't have it.
Well, and in the other room, you have a couple of Tommy guns. I mean, the gangsters were well armed, and they weren't afraid to use those weapons. That must have made it incredibly difficult and terrifying for law enforcement that was trying to crack down.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the FBI, well, they don't start at the beginning. They aren't started until later in the 20s. There is an earlier group that they changed their name to become, but the time began. Yeah, the law enforcement officers did not carry weapons. I mean, the police officers did, but these specific areas did not. So they would go into a place and, you know, after so many officers were shot, they started, you know, letting them have weapons as well, so that they could match up the firepower with the gangsters.
And we did have a little bit of spillover from some of the gangster violence into Iowa. We weren't that far from Chicago.
No. Al Capone spent time in Iowa. John Dillinger spent time in Iowa. I mean, John Dillinger, this I never was able to get confirmed, but there's ideas that his girlfriend's mother lived in Cedar County, is John Dillinger's. Al Capone did spend time at the on the southeast side of Cedar Rapids. There's a restaurant called the Lighthouse Inn, and he actually, there's apparently a bullet hole in the restaurant there that from a gunshot. And I don't know if it was shot by him, but from his time. And that was a little hotel. And I think part of that was just along Highway 30, which was, you know, we think about the interstates crossing Iowa now, but Highway 30 was the way that you would cross. And he would leave Chicago when things would get too hot, and he would go to visit his brother in Omaha. So he'd drive across Iowa, and that might have been a stopping place along the way. So
you have this whole display about law enforcement and some of the investigative procedures that were used up on the wall. You've got a bunch of fingerprint patterns. Did the gangster culture also create sort of an explosion in investigative techniques? Was this another thing that sort of rose because of the gangsters?
Yeah, I think it did. I think it's also also a function of the time and technology developing at the time. And the idea of fingerprints was relatively new in the 20s and using them to solve crimes. But, you know, we've got copies of different fingerprints from different criminals here, you know, John Dillinger's. I think Capone's are – there's those are Capone's. But the fingerprints, you know, are unique to every person. And it's really interesting to look at your fingerprints because people don't think about, you know, they're with you your whole life. They don't change. And how they're used then and today. Now they're entered into a digital database, and they're trying to figure out ways that they can change that. But, you know, crimes were solved. Criminals were captured as a result of finding fingerprints.
It's amazing to look at these fingerprints and think that anybody could have used them to solve crimes. I mean, given the lack of technology at the time, you know, the looking at Al Capone's fingerprints, they just look like black smudges to me. Maybe he wiggled.
He might have wiggled, right? Yeah, they aren't very clean looking. No, no, that's for sure. And I mean, sort of strange to think about it, but the John Dillinger's look more. You know, I don't think these guys were necessarily. They may have been gentlemen in their way of dealing with the public, but I think so. They maybe were gentlemen when they were getting their fingerprints taken. I don't know.
And you've got a wiretapping device over here.
It's called a Bunnell pen register, and what it would do would be a way to gather information on phone calls that people were making. So it was early line tapping, yes, but it would actually record the phone numbers which people called. So if we all think back to the days of
rotary dial phones,
when you'd hear it dial, you would hear the click, 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 you know, and you'd dial whatever, and it would record those clicks, and that was how it was making the phone call, by using those clicks. So it would record that by marking on a strip of paper that's going, winding through, you know, where the different taps were, so they could figure out what the phone number was from that.
And then hopefully trace whoever owned that phone number.
Right,
from
right.
There. Now, with the proliferation of weapons and violence during that time, you also have a little display on protective devices. You've got a bulletproof vest that was actually worn by President Herbert Hoover?
Yeah. That we believe that was worn by him in 1928 on his South American tour. As a protection, there was a death threat against him on that tour, but it was similar, the same type that was worn by law enforcement officers at different times.
It doesn't look very comfortable, and it doesn't look very safe. what are we? It's a wool vest. That's what we're seeing. But obviously, there's something else going on here. What is the protection there?
Inside of the vest, there are metal plates. It's actually quite heavy, steel plates. So I hope they would have worked.
It doesn't look very comfortable.
No, I don't think it was. And Hoover did not like to wear it.
So digging into to this culture? We've talked a lot about how it's something that people consider to be glamorous. I mean, there have been many movies made mm-hmm. and stories told about gangsters. And I mean, in some ways, they became heroes, even though they were criminals and doing really, really nasty stuff. And in digging into this history, how does it change how you think about these guys?
Interesting question, because I would have thought, you know, I've watched a lot of the movies, and I do think of this as, oh, this is a really interesting romantic time about these guys. Oh, they were just like Robin Hood. But no, they were when you start digging into it and you start seeing what they really did, and you start hearing the stories and you start reading the stories and even seeing some of the photographs of stuff, cold-blooded, ruthless people. These were not nice people. Now, I would say that for the gangsters. Now, I don't think that's necessarily true of people who ran speakeasies or for people who also were making, you know, distilling alcohol. I don't think that's necessarily true of them. Some of them, I think, were doing it, you know, they needed the money. This, times were tough. And so this is a way that they could get money. But the bosses of the gangs are pretty nasty people.
So we've talked about law enforcement, but of course people wanted to protect themselves, and bank robbery was a real problem. So you've got a little display here on the Iowa Vigilance Committee. That was a response to gangster activity. Tell me about it.
Right, yeah. The Iowa bankers got together and actually formed an association or a committee, which they were actually sharing information about a bank that was robbed or who, you know, what the person looked like. So it would be postcards that they would send out. But I know in Cedar County, the bankers would get together, I think, once a month, and they'd actually practice shooting. So they would go out. So they were ready to defend themselves at their bank if they needed to.
Wow. And then you've got these little postcards in here from the Iowa Bankers Association. What are those about?
Those are talking about, you know, such and such a place was robbed, you know, on this date, and here's a description of what the person looked like. So they could, you know, if you see somebody who's, you know, well-dressed and dark hair, maybe with a cap, maybe without a cap, you would know that that was a person to look out for.
Wow. So let me read this one. It says, the second robbery in Iowa since June 1st, 1931 occurred this morning at about 9:10 a.m. when the Sioux County Savings Bank in Maurice was held up by two bandits described as follows. First, age 25 to 30 years, height 5'8", weight 150 pounds, dark complexion, dark hair, well-dressed, wore a blue shirt and possibly a cap. So these are like alert posts that would be shared on social media today.
Right, yeah. And you look at the date of that there, you know, how long did it take to publish these things and then to get them mailed out? So you're looking a week,
right.
Maybe.
So, maybe he changed that blue shirt in that time.
And maybe he put on his hat.
Well, I guess you had to do something, right?
Yeah, yeah. So they were, you know, if it made them feel better, I mean, that's part of, you know, if I put a second lock on my door, am I safer? I don't know.
You got to try.
Okay, you got to try.
I think a lot of people think about Iowa, of course, as a very rural state and totally outside of this culture. Were you at all surprised by how pervasive this culture was in Iowa?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a gangster named Cherry Nose Goy out of Des Moines who was Capone's guy, which surprised me. I didn't think that Des Moines would have had his own local boss. That was a surprise to me. That there were, you know, people going around Iowa streets or Iowa roads in the countryside shooting at each other. I think this is a surprise to me. That guy Capone spent time in Cedar Rapids. That these guys were around. I mean, you don't think about it as being in Iowa. You think about it as, you know, Iowans are so nice, right? and, you know, that was a surprise.
When people come and visit the exhibit, what do you want them to take away from the experience?
I want them to see that it was, that we can think of it as having been a fun time, but we also need to look behind the curtain and see that you know, there was this really shady side of this that really did cost people, you know, lives, cost people, you know, their houses, their, you know, their families, whatever. there are horrible things that happen at this time that we don't think about as being a part of that. We disassociate those from that.
Marcus, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Glad you're able to come out.
Thinking of a misbehaving, saving my love for you.
We've been touring the exhibit Ain't Misbehavin', The World of the Gangsters. It's on display through October 23rd at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum in West Branch, Iowa. I've been talking with curator Marcus Eckhart. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the rise of gangster culture in the 1920s. And there have been so many movies made, books written, both fiction and nonfiction, about that culture. And people are still fascinated by the mobsters who rose to power during Prohibition. And of all these men, the one that still captivates people the most is Scarface himself, Al Capone. The Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch will be hosting a Capone expert on Saturday, August 20th at 2 p.m. The event is open to the public, and Jonathan Eig is here with me now. He's the author of Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captured America's Most Wanted Gangster, and many other books. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here. And I want to go back to that time during Prohibition, because in your book you paint a really beautiful picture of the culture that launched Capone. And what was it about that time in Chicago that made it possible for a man like Al Capone to get so much power?
Well, you know, it wasn't really just Chicago. It was all over the country in big towns and small towns. There was this sense that Prohibition just didn't really ever have a fair chance to work. You know, it was something that people thought made sense when we first began discussing an amendment to the Constitution. The country was in the middle of war, World War One. There was a sense that we needed to sacrifice. There was a sense that people were drinking too much, that wives were being abused by their husbands because they were drunk, and that this, you know, cutting down on the alcohol would just be a good, prudent thing to do. That we all needed to sober up a little bit. But by the time the law took effect, the culture had changed. The war was over, the economy was booming, and people didn't want to sacrifice anymore. They wanted to have a good time. And then you take away booze, which is a huge industry, which is obviously something people did not always abuse. They used it responsibly, and there was this great backlash. So it wasn't just Chicago and it wasn't just Capone. There were ordinary people all over the country who just said, this is a really bad law. We don't do that in America. We don't take away people's freedoms. And that made it possible for people like Capone to step into this business and say, yeah, this is a pretty good operation. I can make a lot of money doing something that used to be legal, that's a lot safer and a lot more lucrative than the kind of work they were doing before. So you see this incredible backlash very quickly.
Well, and it's so ironic because, as you write, when Prohibition was originally talked about, that amendment was ratified really easily. There wasn't an organized opposition. And then by the time it actually went into law, there seemed to be a general understanding that, you know, we're just going to flout this law.
Yeah, and the government never really thought that there would be any need to enforce it. They thought everybody would just voluntarily sober up, and that the beer manufacturers, the breweries, and the distilleries would all just happily go out of business, and that would be the end of the story. So there was no enforcement mechanism. There really wasn't any federal workforce in place to make sure the laws were obeyed, and local police and sheriff departments weren't going to take on that kind of a massive job. So it was really easy for these bootleggers to step in and sell this stuff and make a lot of money.
And Capone in Chicago, there was kind of a unique culture there, because Chicago had already kind of proven itself to be a city that was difficult to police.
That's putting it politely, yes. And there is a reason why Chicago became the poster child for the problems of Prohibition, and that's because The police department had never really caught up to the size of the city. When Chicago enjoyed its huge population boom in the century prior, the police department had never kept up, and pay was very low for police officers, so they were very easily bribed. It was impossible for an undermanned police force to keep up with the bootlegging anyway. And then once the bootleggers started offering bribes, it just made a lot more sense for cops to take the money and look the other way. They were drinking too. Their neighbors were drinking. This was not a law that anybody really wanted to see enforced. So as long as the gangsters weren't killing innocent civilians, they were prepared to just let it go. And even when the gangsters killed each other, the police usually didn't bother to get involved. In fact, there were no prosecutions for murder in the 1920s in Chicago among gangsters. Every case just managed to go away.
Wow. Now, tell me a little bit about Al Capone as a man, as he was in the early 1920s when he started putting together that operation in Chicago.
He came from Brooklyn, and he left New York because he was wanted by the police there, and he came to Chicago and began working as a bartender and a bouncer, and really did not have a lot of aspirations. He was a high school dropout. And it was, when Prohibition came along just after he arrived in Chicago, suddenly all these opportunities presented themselves. And he proved willing to do some of the dirty work that allowed him to rise through the organization in Chicago. And he proved pretty savvy. He was he was actually a likable guy. People enjoyed his company. So he had a good time. He had an easy time putting together an operation of people who would be loyal to him. And he was also, cutthroat enough to eliminate the competition and to eliminate people within his organization who were not loyal. So it was a combination, really, an interesting combination of tolerance for violence and, actually, believe it or not, a likable personality that helped him rise to the top. And then also, a fair bit of luck that the certain people around him managed, to get themselves killed, and he did not. That played an important role, too.
Well, and you say savvy. Do you think he was a really intelligent guy? Was he very smart?
He was not book smart by any stretch, but I think he had good a good understanding of people. He was able to read people very well, and he was fairly smart strategically. A lot of people think of him as a brilliant businessman who was raking in millions of bucks, and I tend to think those kinds of statements are inflated. I don't think he was a brilliant businessman. I think he was clever and he was shrewd, and he was smart enough to know that you had to bribe people to stay in business. So I think he was just smart enough to stay in business as long as he did. What really set Capone apart from other gangsters was his tolerance for publicity. Other gangsters, other criminals, it kind of makes sense. If you're doing something illegal, you want to keep quiet about it. Don't call too much attention to yourself. But Capone saw it differently. He really thought that he could be a celebrity gangster, that he could have his picture on magazine covers, and he could give interviews to the press. And some of that is because Prohibition was so unpopular. He really thought he was providing a legitimate service to people. But some of it was just his personality. He liked the attention. And that is really why he's the most famous gangster today.
Because he set out to make himself the most famous gangster.
He wanted to be famous, whereas, his rivals, his friends, even his cohorts were saying, what are you doing? What's wrong with you? We don't want all this attention. We're trying to make, we're making money, faster than we can count it. Just shut up. He didn't see things that way.
Well, and certainly to a point, he was absolutely right about that. That people, you mentioned how likable he was. Obviously, this thrall kind of still exists until today. That worked for him, right?
Yeah, it worked pretty well, except for the fact that it called attention to him, and he ultimately fell into the crosshairs of the federal government and Herbert Hoover in particular, which is why I'm speaking at the Hoover Library on Saturday, because by making himself the most famous gangster in the world, he invited scrutiny, and Herbert Hoover wanted to make an example of him. He felt like, Capone and these other gangsters who were so forthright and so boastful about getting away with these crimes had to be stopped, and it was, it was embarrassing the federal government to have them out there. So in the end, I think that was also, Capone's downfall.
I'm talking with Jonathan Eig. He's the author of Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captured America's Most Wanted Gangster. And he'll be in West Branch speaking at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum on Saturday, August 20th at 2 p.m. And Jonathan, what do we know about what Herbert Hoover said and felt about Al Capone? Was he on record and talking specifically about Capone?
Yeah, he was. He talked about it a lot, and some people said that he talked about it every day during his cabinet meetings. Because, you know, we forget that Hoover, he's mostly associated with the Great Depression and with the, you know, the failures of his administration to deal with the Great Depression quickly and aggressively enough. But he came into office during a time of enormous prosperity, and the, you know, the country was at peace, and he inherited a, you know, country that seemingly had not that much work to do. We were in great shape, and he vowed that he was going to crack down on crime, that he was going to clean up America's justice system, which was really flawed and had been corrupted by bootleggers like Capone. And one of the very first things he did when he came into office was to vow that he was not going to elect, he was not going to allow guys like Capone to continue getting away with murder, literally. And he asked his cabinet meeting every day, where are we on the Capone investigation? He really took it personally. He wanted to see Capone put out of operation. And I think, you know, it's really the first time that the federal government has allotted that kind of manpower, those kinds of resources to taking down one man. It was another part of the reason why Capone is so well known today was because he became public enemy number one, not just in Chicago, but it became a federal case.
Now, before he was president, Herbert Hoover was the Secretary of Commerce. Do you think Capone was on his radar then? Because, of course, here he is making an incredible amount of money in a field that used to pay taxes to the government and now didn't anymore. Was it already something that he was thinking about, do you think?
He may well have been. I mean, Hoover was very much a law and order man and very much, you know, a guy who liked to do things by the books. He was, you know, very careful about it. And he was, you know, I think it offended every fiber, every bone in his body to see somebody just making a mockery of the law. And he often said, you know, you don't have to like prohibition. It may not be a good law, but it is the law. And until we change it, then it has to be obeyed. And Capone was just, you know, in many ways he became a scapegoat because Hoover felt like he needed to show that he was serious about this. And the best way to do it, the best way to get the attention of the whole country, was to take out Al Capone.
Now, the plot to get Capone is, of course, something that has been told in fictionalized versions many times. And when your book first came out in 2010, you were detailing the plot to get Capone in kind of a new way. And of course, a lot of us remember the movie The Untouchables and Elliot Ness taking down Capone. And Elliot Ness, this, you know, very famous lawman, FBI man, wasn't, by your account, as involved in that plot as most of us would think.
No, Ness is mostly a creation of Hollywood. He was working as a prohibition agent, and he was involved in the investigations of Capone, and he did help, you know, shut down a few breweries, and he did help disrupt the cash flow to Capone's organization a little bit, but nothing in his investigations ever led to an arrest or to a conviction and of anyone even associated with Capone, much less Capone. The credit here really goes to Hoover for pushing this thing, and to the accountants in the IRS who did the work of building a case against Capone, and the lawyer who presented that case and had the courage to say, I'm willing to face the embarrassment of admitting that I can't put him away for bootlegging, I can't put him away for murder, the best I can do is an income tax case, and I know I'm going to be laughed at for that, but we really just need to get him off the streets, and if we get him off the streets, his organization will fall apart. So it was in very much the mode of Herbert Hoover, who was a modest public servant who didn't care who got the credit. They did this thing in the most practical way, not in the attention-getting way that Elliot Ness and his in the movies would have you believe.
So he did get sent to prison for tax fraud. And you write that that also in some ways made him even more sympathetic with the public, because while people may not be able to relate to a murderer, the public found it pretty easy to relate to somebody who'd committed tax fraud.
Yeah, if you think about it, everybody hated prohibition because the government was taking away their right to have a beer after work. And what's the other thing that every American hates? The IRS, right, paying their taxes. So all of a sudden, Capone becomes kind of a Robin Hood. He's the guy who was giving them what they wanted. He was getting the beer to the people, and then the IRS puts him away for not paying his taxes on his income, which was, of course, you know, illegal income. And you know, the great irony there is, you know, what are you supposed to do if you're making illegal income? Are you supposed to report that to the IRS? Would you report it to the IRS if you were, if all of your income was illegally gotten? Probably not. So suddenly, you know, Capone became a little bit more of a sympathetic figure, and then he went away to prison and became sick. He, you know, he had syphilis and developed neurological symptoms, and really was never the same. So he, you know, he was not this menacing figure anymore. He was this sick man. So it was not the kind of end that most of these gangsters come to.
Now, Al Capone still has this thrall over people. You know, in 2010, you wrote a book about him, but there have been so many books, many movies. Why do you think the legend of this man endures?
I think it's for a couple of reasons. One, you know, criminals just fascinate us. All you have to do is look at Hollywood and see what, you know, half the movies are about criminals. And that's because Freud said it's because we all secretly wish to break the law and get away with it. And I think there's something to that. And I think in Capone's case, it's not only because he thought he could get away with it, but because he thought he could be an American celebrity at the same time. He thought he could be the Babe Ruth and the Lucky Lindbergh of crime, and that somehow he could legitimize it, and he could, you know, put on the fancy suits and the expensive ties and become criminal royalty. I think that's what makes it so fascinating. And he was also so young at the time. We forget that he was, you know, he rose to power at the age of 26 and was pretty much done by the time he was in his early 30s. So it's just an amazing American story. I think it, you know, could never have happened anywhere else.
Jonathan Eich, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Eich is the author of Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captured America's Most Wanted Gangster. It's out in paperback, and he'll be at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch on Saturday, August 20th at 2 p.m. The event is open to the public. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.